Chapter 35. Chateau Wraith hadn't changed much since my last visit. That's one of the good things about dealing with nigh immortals. They tend to adjust badly to change and avoid it wherever possible. It was a big place, north of the city, where the countryside rolls over a surprising variety of terrain. Flat stretches of rich land that used to be farms but are mostly big, expensive properties now. Dozens of little rivers and big creeks have carved hills and valleys more steep than most people expect from the Midwest. The trees out in that area, one of the older settlements in the United States, can be absolutely huge, and it would cost me 5 or 6 years' worth of income to buy even a tiny house. Chateau Wraith is surrounded by a forest of those enormous, ancient trees, as if someone had managed to transplant a section of Sherwood Forest itself from Britain. You can't see a thing of the estate from any of the roads around it. I knew it was at least a half-mile run through the trees before you got to the grounds, which were enormous in their own right. Translation: you weren't getting away from the chateau on foot speed alone, not if there were vampires there to run you down. There was one new feature to the grounds. The 8-foot-high stone wall was the same, but it had been topped with a double helix of razor wire, and lighting had been spaced along the outside of the wall. I could see security cameras at regular intervals as well. The old Lord Wraith had disdained the more modern security precautions in favor of the protection of intense personal arrogance. Lara, however, seemed more willing to acknowledge threats, to listen to her mortal security staff, and to employ the countermeasures they suggested. It would certainly help keep the mortal riffraff out, and the Council had plenty of mortal allies. More important, it said something about Lara's administration. She found skilled subordinates and then listened to them. She might not look as overwhelmingly confident as Lord Wraith had, but then Lord Wraith wasn't running the show anymore either, even if that wasn't public knowledge in the magical community. I reflected that it was entirely possible that I might have done the Council and the world something of a disservice by helping Lara assume control. Lord Wraith had been proud and brittle. I had the feeling that Lara would prove to be far, far more capable and far more dangerous as the de facto White King. And here I was, about to go to her aid again and help solidify her power even more. "Stop here," I told Molly quietly. The gates to the chateau were still a quarter mile down the road. "This is as close as you get." "Right," Molly said, and pulled the beetle over onto the far side of the road, I noted with approval, where anyone wanting to come to her would have to cross the open pavement to get there. "Mouse," I said, "stay here with Molly and listen for us. Take care of her." Mouse looked unhappily at me from the back seat, where he'd sat with Ramirez, but leaned forward and dropped his shaggy chin onto my shoulder. I gave him a quick hug and said in a gruff voice, "Don't worry, we'll be fine." His tail thumped once against the back seat, and then he shifted around to lay his head on Molly's shoulder. She immediately started scratching him reassuringly behind the ear, though her own expression was far from comfortable. I gave the girl half of a smile and then got out of the car. Summer twilight was fading fast, and it was too hot to wear my duster. I had it on anyway, and I added the weight of the gray cloak of the wardens of the White Council to the duster. Under all that, I wore a white silk shirt and cargo pants of heavy black cotton, plus my hiking boots. "Hat," I muttered. "Spurs. Next time, I swear." Ramirez slid out of the beetle, grenades and gun and willow sword hanging from his belt, and staff gripped in his right hand. He paused to pull on a glove made out of heavy leather, overlaid with a layer of slender steel plates, each inscribed with pictoglyphs that looked Aztec or Olmec or something. "That's new," I commented. He winked at me, and we checked our guns. My .44 revolver went back into my left-hand duster pocket, his back into its sheath. "You sure you don't want a grenade or two?" he asked. "I'm not comfortable with hand grenades," I said. "So do yourself," he replied. "How about you, Molly?" He turned back to the car, hand on one of his grenades. The car was gone. The engine was still idling audibly. Ramirez let out a whistle and waved his staff into the space it had occupied until it clinked against metal. "Hey, not a bad veil. Pretty damn good, in fact." She's got a gift, I said. Molly's voice came from nearby. Thanks. Ramirez gave the approximate space where my apprentice sat a big grin and a gallant, vaguely Spanish little bow. Molly let out a suppressed giggle. The car's engine cut out, and she said, Go on. I've got to keep compensating for the dust you're kicking up, and it's a pain. Eyes open, I told her. Use your head. You too, Molly said. Don't tell him to start new things now, Ramirez chided her. You'll just confuse him. I'm getting dumber by the minute, I confirmed. Ask anybody. From the unseen car, Mouse snorted out a breath. See? I said, and started walking toward the entrance to the estate. Ramirez kept up, but only by taking a skipping step every several paces. My legs are lots longer than his. After 100 yards or so, he laughed. All right, you made your point. I grunted and slowed marginally. Ramirez looked back over his shoulder. Think she'll be all right? Tough to sneak up on Mouse, I said, even if they realize she's there. Pretty. A body like that? And talent, too. Ramirez stared back thoughtfully. She seeing anyone? Not since she drilled holes in her last boyfriend's psyche and drove him insane. Ramirez winced. Right.